Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Sean Wildermuth. Sean has been tinkering with computers and software since he got a VIC-20 back in the early 80s. As a Microsoft MVP since 2003, he's been involved with Microsoft as an ASP.NET insider and a client dev insider. He's the author of over 20 Pluralsight courses. He's written 8 books. He's an international conference speaker and one of the wilder minds. You can reach him at his blog at http://wildermuth.com. He's also making his first feature-length documentary about software developers called Hello World the Film. You can see more about it at helloworldfilm.com. That's what I want to talk to him about. Sean is also a personal friend, a truly great guy, and I'm really happy to have him here. Sean, how are you?
I am great. I found like four bugs in my bio just by watching you read it. That's awesome.
That's very cool. Now, before I get to the movie and I get to all the other things I want to talk to you about, I'm going to ask you something I've asked you before. What year did we meet?
I have no idea anymore. Late 80s? Late 90s, I think?
Yeah, I think late 90s. Late 80s would be scary.
Yeah, maybe mid-90s, but I know it was in the 90s. It was before the bubble burst.
Yes, that makes sense. Okay, yeah. I don't want to bore everybody with that, and we can take that offline, but it is kind of cool. You're making a movie, and I really want to talk to you about the movie, but before I do, you're also doing some training. Is this live training on site?
It is. I'm branching back out into doing some face-to-face training because, frankly, I miss it. I've been thinking a lot about it. I've spent the last 3 or 4 years doing exclusively online training, and I miss the interaction I get with people in doing face-to-face. I'm only going to do 3 or 4 this year in different cities, but we're starting with Atlanta in May, and then we're going to branch out into some other U.S. cities through the rest of the year, and I'll have announcements about that on my blog when it happens. But May 16th through 18th, I'm doing an ASP.NET Core and Angular course here in Atlanta.
Well, that is something I would really – is that one course or is that two?
No, that's one. We basically do what I do in the Pluralsight course, and we build a website in 3 days.
Maybe I'll come down for that.
Yeah, that would be great.
What's the date on that?
That's May 16th through 18th.
Okay, we'll look at that. So you're doing Angular and Core. Let's talk about both of those. And when you're talking about Angular, can you help me understand the difference between Angular, React.js, and Vue.js? I know that's a big topic, but can you just give me a overview of the differences?
Sure. React is probably the biggest, the most exciting one right now in most people's minds. I'm not a big fan of it because of some of the way that it's developed. And I know there'll be a lot of people that will then put in the comments of your blog how wrong I am about this. But the idea of mixing markup and code into these files together makes me cringe a little. So I've done a little React work here or there. I probably don't understand it well enough to understand why I should love it, but it's one I'm not focusing on. And of course, I've been in the Angular world, which is Angular to me has been really made to build industrial-sized SPAs or single-page applications, these large, management panels or data entry systems, sort of the core of what I've been building most of my career. And I think it does a really good job of that. The one place it falls down to me is when you need just a little interactivity. So when you want to enhance a website or do something smaller, there's so much ceremony in Angular that unless you're building something industrial-sized, a lot of that ceremony can get in the way. You know, spend 2 days setting up the project and 1 day coding the project, and it starts to feel painful.
Yes.
And so that's one place I've been using Vue.js a lot, which is a much smaller library, more discreet at what it does. It can do full power SPAs in the same way that Angular and React can do, but it's really also tunable down to I just need, validation in my contact page. And so when people are just enhancing a few pages on a mostly read-only website, I've been pointing them at Vue as a solution there as well. So I think all three really have their space. I think Angular is still the king of the industrial size SPA. I think React is really good when you're dealing with lots of components. And what's interesting about that idea is I think that React coming out of Facebook makes total sense because their whole website is just a bunch of components, right? You can almost see when you look at Facebook that that little piece is its own thing, and that little piece is its own thing, and this little piece is its own thing. And I don't think that a lot of applications are end up being written in that way. But if you do need that, if you're building like dashboards, React probably is a great solution for that because you don't have a lot of interactivity between them. Whereas I think Vue.js is sort of in the middle of them. When you need, like I keep on espousing this idea of interactivity on just the web, you know, you could imagine something like a super version of Knockout or something like that. And one of the approaches I like about what they did is they don't want to be responsible for anything that they aren't good at. So for instance, even, you know, making HTTP requests, they don't have an opinion about it. They have point you to some other libraries that do it, but they're not going to get in the business of actually making those requests, because why would they rewrite that library when there's six or seven great libraries that already do it, whether it's jQuery or Axiom or one of those guys?
I've been away from hardline web programming for too long. I've been doing mobile, and now I'm deep into Azure, and fascinating to me how rapidly things are moving along in the web world with, you know, the last time I looked, Angular was the new kid on the block and very, very hot. And these days I hear a lot about React.js and now today about Vue. So that seems like it's a rapidly changing ecosystem.
I think it is. React is certainly the hot one right now. A lot of people are looking at and building great systems with it. And it might have its, you know, sort of maturation like Angular has, where it becomes this sort of, you know, big citizen in the world, sort of like, you know, Java and C++ are. And I kind of feel like that's where it is. The big change that's happened, I think, in the last few years is just the adoption of writing JavaScript using the latest versions of JavaScript instead of having to worry about earlier, whether that's using TypeScript or using Babel or whatever way. Most people are not writing it the way they did just 3 or 4 years ago. They really are, you know, building classes and using interfaces, and in the case of TypeScript, using type safety and all of those pieces. So, you know, certainly the client side dev has changed a lot, you know, in just 3 years. And I think it's about probably to change again. I don't know if you're familiar with WebAssembly. So WebAssembly is a standard to basically, you know, be the IL of the browser so that no matter what language you're building it in, you can build these runnable components in the browser. And if it succeeds, then you'll see people writing C# or Java or JavaScript or TypeScript or, you know, F# and producing web assemblies, which are assemblies inside the browser to do the client side. And I think that's going to change the way we write code in the browser quite a bit.
Change everything. Yeah, I mean, if you can write in C# and be a meaningful web developer, that is extraordinary. I mean, that will really, that between that and the fact that you can use C# to build mobile applications, and C# is in many ways the language of choice for doing back end Azure stuff, that is very, very exciting because you could do the back end and the front end all in the same language.
Yeah, which is the promise with something like Xamarin, and you can imagine if it moves over to the web and becomes that story, that is the big change, that it's a huge change of everything. And we can get rid of some of the complexity that's happened in web development as of late, like Webpack, which I particularly hate and use, even though I have to use it, but I really hate what it's done to web development.
Tell me just 2 seconds on why you hate it.
Well, Webpack, like Babel, like even TypeScript in some ways, are adding multiple build steps to what used to be a very quick turnaround very simple way of writing apps for the web. But now that we have to have three transpilers in the mix before we're actually debugging, and then we're debugging against map files instead of the actual code, it just makes my head spin. Again, the ceremony versus actually getting to write code for a living frustrates me. And Webpack is in the middle of it all. You can certainly use Webpack with Vue.js, but you can also write Vue.js without it. Though Angular is really tied to Webpack for basically, you know, the idea behind Webpack is we're going to look through all your code. We're going to find only the code that executes, and then we're going to package it up together and try to make it as efficient as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece of like packaging it up together is sort of the magic. So instead of having, you know, six different libraries, you know, jQuery and Angular and that the browser is downloading, they're going to just download this JavaScript file that has the pieces of Angular you're using, the pieces of jQuery you're using, the pieces of your code you're using in this one distributable, which is a great idea. But I think it really slows down web development. What frustrates me about it is we used to do this sort of thing as a production step, and now it's become part of the development process. And the idea of making it part of the production step makes a lot of sense to me. Let's, you know, concatenate, let's bundle them together if we want to, all that sort of thing when we're ready for production. But I feel like it's getting in the way of the speed of development because we have to have that build step every time.
Yes. I want to go back to a couple of things you said. One was about TypeScript, which for me was a huge change. And I argue, for what it's worth, that TypeScript has been oversold to the JavaScript world and undersold to the C-sharp world. I do a presentation called TypeScript for C-sharp Developers, and the reason for that is that I see it as a gateway drug into the web for C-sharp developers.
And yeah, I think that's fair.
Arguably, it goes both ways, that JavaScript developers who want to begin to understand type safety and objects might find TypeScript an easier path than jumping into something like C-sharp.
I think that's true on both ends. But what I think people miss is that TypeScript's push is to have the language of where JavaScript is going. Mm-hmm. So it is a superset of JavaScript, so it's still JavaScript. And at some point, TypeScript slowly gets peeled away as JavaScript becomes more capable. So instead of inventing what, you know, just what Microsoft wants, they're really building based on what the browsers have implemented in JavaScript already. Even type safety, even though we're probably years from JavaScript actually having type safety, even that was designed with non-Microsoft people involved. And to me, that's why I think you're right that it is a gateway drug for both sides. It is this link between them. But it also will teach, I think it's important for web developers to want to do it, or I should say JavaScript developers, because they can start to write the JavaScript they're going to have to write in 3 or 4 or 5 years anyway. The idea that we're now entering into, past ECMAScript 5, well, TypeScript has had the ECMAScript 6 pieces already working for a while, and now ECMAScript, whatever the version is after that, with async and await and some other things to really simplify the code, and those are standards that have been adopted by ECMA and the browser manufacturers on board. And so I see it as more the future proof of JavaScript, though it is an easy way for C-sharp developers to get on that without having to just sit around and complain all the time.
Yes. Yeah, I used to worry a lot about not knowing Python and not knowing Ruby, and lately not knowing Go. I mean, the list of things I don't know is a lot longer than the list of things I do know. But but even in the world that I do live, I know this is an old thing to say, but the pace of change is itself increasing. So keeping up is, maybe I'm just getting old, but keeping up is getting harder to do.
Well, and I keep on thinking that, but I remember Chris Tavares, who I used to work with at DevelopMentor. He's the one who said, you really should try this Python thing. And this was 99, maybe, mm-hmm. So the idea that Python has been a real language that people have been using for, at least 17 years, it sort of blew my head apart the other day, because a lot of people think of it as this, new up and coming language that happens to be 20 years old or whatever the actual age of Python is. It's kind of interesting. I have some problems with Python, but I think you're right that, the problem I have is picking from what might be the winners, but what it seems like if I didn't like it for some reason, it's probably going to be around for a long time.
Great. I can contra bet on you. That's great.
It's not a bad bet, Silverlight, object spaces, et cetera.
Now, you mentioned .NET Core, and I know that you have not mentioned your Pluralsight course, but you have a killer Pluralsight course on .NET Core and Angular. Am I right about that?
Yeah, we updated it to .NET Core 2 and Angular 4.3, which was the latest in November. when we released it in November, and we rewrote it. I rewrote it from the ground up to try to get around some of the common problems people were having. I changed out the demo to be a little clearer, and Core 2.0 introduced a lot of things that fixed workarounds that were in the first core. So I was able to actually rip out a bunch of sections that no longer were valid because Visual Studio just did the right thing, or, you know, writing this or that was a lot easier than it used to be. So it was kind of a pleasure to see the maturation of a framework like Core, in that all the things I was teaching in one, a bunch of them I could just go, oh, it just works now. Okay, good. Oh, that workaround isn't necessary anymore. Oh, good.
That's very cool. And is the new course doing as well as the old?
It's still in the top 10. Wow. Not quite as good as the other course, but it's still doing well.
That's great. Yeah. And you'll still remember us little people. That's great. which brings me to your new project, which is the movie.
Yeah.
Tell me everything about the movie. Everything.
So I've always loved documentary films. I love the idea of them and love the idea of maybe making one day, though I'm certainly not a filmmaker by trade or anything. And as a extension of the Hello World podcast, my podcast where we talk about how people got started, I started to think about different problems in software development. And one of them was that, you know, I'm close to 50 now, and I've never been able to explain to my wife, to my mother when she was alive, really what I did. I was never able to really explain what it was. And so this idea of a movie started with the idea that I wanted to teach, I wanted to explain in programmers' words why, what we do, why we do it, so why we're so passionate about it on the whole, you know, why we go home at night and tinker with more code even though we've been writing it all day. And that was sort of the genesis of this idea of making a film. And as I dug into it, I realized I also wanted to talk about some of the problems in software development right now, around mostly around underrepresentation of women and minorities in software development. And that sort of came from a conversation, and I don't know who I was having it with, but we were talking about American women in software development, because I worked with a lot of Asian women in software development, people from the Indian subcontinent, people from China and Korea. And it occurred to me that I'd never worked with an American woman as a software developer, you know, QA, marketing, writers, all of that, but never actually a software developer. And what bothered me about that wasn't that I'd never worked with one, is that I never noticed. That really bothered me. Like, it never even occurred to me that most of the people I worked with were either expatriates from another country or they were white guys from the U.S. And that sort of started down this sort of genesis of what I'm trying to, you know, talk about in the film, not only explain what we do, but also how that sort of interacted and affected the fact that, you know, women are underrepresented and blacks and Latinas are super underrepresented. Blacks only make up 2.5% from the numbers I've found of the software developers, which is, you know, a pittance compared to the 20% that are women. And so we're going to explore those. I don't know that I have any solutions for anything, but the movie's really meant to explore that. And it's been an interesting process because it's such a long process. We're probably not going to be out until late 2019, early 2020, and I've been working on it for over a year.
That is a hell of a project. I want to stay for a minute on women and minorities in terms of how you're approaching that, how you're finding people to talk with. Are you talking with the folks from Girls Who Code? What organizations are you talking to?
We're talking with Girls Who Code and Women Who Code. They're actually two different organizations. We're also talking with educators. So we went and talked to Maria Clave. I don't know if you know who she is.
I'm afraid I don't.
She used to be on the Microsoft board, but she's the president of Harvey Mudd College. And we had a great conversation with her because they've been able to change their numbers from 18% women graduating with computer science degrees to just about 50, somewhere between 48 and 51%, depending on the year. And their approaches, because as one of the people we interviewed at Harvey Mudd talked about, he said everyone in the different parts of the problem think that the problem needs to be fixed elsewhere. So in secondary education, they think it's in primary education. They think it's the high schools aren't getting them interested, and so they're not coming to college. And in the industry, we think it's a pipeline problem because they're not graduating enough. And in high school, they think it's that the colleges aren't helping them know what to teach them well enough. So everyone's sort of playing this blame game with actually graduating enough candidates. But I also think there's, you know, I think it's a multi-pronged problem. One of the things I'm baffled by is I've had some short conversations, but haven't gotten them on film yet, from Georgia Tech, and they say they're graduating quite a lot of African-American software developers, but I don't know where they went. So they're graduating them, but they're not showing up in some of the industry numbers. But most of the industry numbers are from West Coast Big Ten tech companies.
Yes.
And so there's this sort of missing 90% of software developers that I'm trying to figure out how to reach.
Right. But the Big Ten are where you would expect to see the most diversity early on, where you'll see more commitment because they, A, can afford it, and B, everybody's watching them. So if you're not seeing it there, I find that surprising.
Well, you know, that's what I think is true, but I have to try to figure out how to prove it. And that's sort of the question. Is it that they're not staying in it? Is it they're starting startups? Or is it the fact that the Big Ten tech companies are all on the West Coast, where the representation of African Americans is just simply smaller? When you think about Latino on the West Coast, that one surprises me that they're not bigger. But there's actually more Latino and Latina in the Big Ten companies than African Americans. And so it might be an East Coast, West Coast bias, because, you know, Microsoft and Apple and Google, they're all West Coast companies. And if you've ever been to Seattle, you know, all seven of their black people, right, you know, probably already work at Microsoft.
Right.
Yes. It's not like, you know, Montgomery, Alabama, or Atlanta, or Chicago, Detroit, where the communities themselves have a lot of representation. There's just not as many tech companies there, but there are a lot of programmers there, right? Because most programmers don't work for a tech company. Most programmers work for Ford and Coca-Cola and Geico, and, you know, the majority of developers are in non-technical companies doing technical work.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. If you go, however, to conferences, and maybe that's not a good representation of the industry, and that there are a whole lot of programmers who are doing their job and not going to conferences. But you look around at conferences, and it is kind of frightening how underrepresented women and blacks and Latinos are.
Absolutely.
It's much smaller than the percentage in the population.
And that's absolutely true. And that's what we're trying to figure out, is it these, you know, workaday developers that tend to get lost? Are they working for companies that don't encourage training? You know, what is it? Because even if you think about the supposed 20% of women software developers, there's no way 20% of conference attendees are women. There's no way that number's
accurate. Even close. Right.
No.
So that's obviously becoming a bigger part of your documentary. Is that the focus now, or are you also talking to folks about how and why they got into the industry?
Both. So the idea is the movie's really separated into these three acts, like you would think a movie would be. And the first one is this, what do we do, why they got into it? Though I'm not trying to duplicate what we've done with the Hello World podcast. I'm more interested in trying to explain why we're so passionate and what it looks like. Why we look like we're working when sometimes we're playing, right? That problem of our play looks like our work, that happens in a lot of situations. We're also talking to some people about, like, how they've had to handle work-life balance. You know, people I've had more than one occasion where divorces were really because of their job choice, because they were so dedicated to what they were doing that they maybe weren't great husbands or wives because of it. I think that all, you know, that is all around what our business is. And some of it is just, you know, the personality of developers being so myopic in some ways.
I'd be interested also, I don't know if you're going to look at this, but I'd be personally interested in the phenomenon that I saw when I worked at larger non-technical companies, of the many of the best developers being moved rapidly into management.
Yeah. And it's been an interesting, as we've done interviews, quite a number of them are now managing developers, and whether that's a good or a bad thing. And, you know, if I could make the movie 10 hours, I've actually considered making it a series instead of just a movie. But I'm also very interested in the phenomenon of everyone thinking that that you need all these, you know, alpha male developers. Like, we need to go get ourselves a team of superstar developers. And the problem is that they usually don't work as a team very well. The idea that if you had a football team full of quarterbacks, you're not going to play football very effectively, but you do, you would have the best, you know, 20 players in football maybe, but that doesn't mean you're ever going to win a game with all quarterbacks. And that's kind of what software development feels like when I hear companies that just want superstar developers.
Who is it that you've been talking with so far? Are they folks who others are going to know from the industry, or are they more people who you've come across who are in less visible positions?
A little of both. We've talked to people in the education, which I've talked about already, but we've also have some, you know, big names that we've already talked to, including Richard Campbell and Scott Hanselman, and we talked to Debbie Corrada, Lawrence Bignon, if I'm saying his name right, you never know. I think we've already interviewed 23 different people, and we're going to probably do about 50 by the time we're done. We're trying to get some bigger names that I really want to talk to, like Linda Gates and Margaret Hambleton, who I email once a month, even though she never responds, because I'd really like to talk to her. She was the chief programmer on the Apollo missions. And kind of seeing, you know, where things have gone since then, because there were a lot more women in software development in the 60s than there were in the 80s.
Yeah.
So the big get so far is going to be John Romero. We're going to go out to Ireland and interview him. I wanted to speak to him because of obviously his experience working with John Carmack on Doom and his long history in the game development world. And only when I actually got reached him and talked to him briefly did I realize that he's also he's Mexican and Native American. So I think he's going to have some interesting revelations about what it's like to not be a white guy in development as well.
Tell me about who you think your target audience is. Is it techies or more general?
I think the movie will certainly interest techies or developers. But my goal is to have a general audience. So I want people who know and love developers to want to watch this way more than I want this to be for, you know, inside baseball talk about the about the industry. And that's a challenge, because trying to get interviews with people where they're not throwing out, you know, languages and acronyms and those sorts of things has been a challenge. And trying to really pull it back and go, you know, can you tell me that story again, but without mentioning the seven technologies that you're really interested in right now?
You may need subtitles.
Yeah, I've considered it.
What about distribution? Have you thought about where this is going to be seen?
Yes, I've thought about it quite a lot. We plan is at the end, when it gets finished at late next year, is we're going to go and spend 3 or 4 months doing film festivals. So we've got a handful that we really want to do, and then we'll probably submit to another handful, probably do 6 or 8, with the idea of trying to get an interest of a Netflix or an HBO or, you know, one of those guys. I want it to have as wide of distribution as possible. Yeah, making documentary films, there's no money in it. It's much more about, I want to get this story out there. And that would be the way to get it, you know, into the widest audience. But this being my first film, who knows? Worst case, I'll put it out for free on YouTube and tell everyone about it. But hopefully, you know, the goal is to actually get real distribution.
Right. Let me just dive for 2 minutes into some of the technical aspects of it. What are you shooting with, any kind of special equipment? What's involved in doing that?
So we are shooting with DSLRs. So they shoot in 4K. And they're really made for filmmaking, for sort of budget filmmaking. And the benefit of using those, not just because the costs are, you know, doable and that they're producing really good imagery, is that because most of our interviews aren't where I live, it makes them very portable for me to take a whole, you know, studio full of stuff with me. We're using LED lights instead of traditional lights because they travel better. You know, recording sound separately, using, you know, probably the same, what are those things called? Zooms that we used these days, lavalier mics and all of that sort of thing. So it's not a terribly difficult process, but it also means that I need 2 people to record the interview. So I have a cinematographer who travels with me and does the actual shooting, and I handle the sound and ask the questions and that sort of thing. So my role is closer to a director, and hers is closer to a cinematographer. But it's a pretty discreet little setup that we have. One one Pelican case and one little roller bag, and that's our whole studio with us. So it's been very interesting to sort of see what all it takes, and that the democratization of filmmaking is in full flow right now, you know, because, you know, I edit on a laptop and I shoot on prosumer equipment, you know, not, you know, $20,000, $50,000 cameras, but, you know, like $1,000 cameras. And it all looks great. The only technical problem is that making documentaries requires a lot of storage. So I say documentary specifically because when narrative films are made, they shoot about 4 minutes for every 1 minute of film time because they plan it very carefully so that they know how much film is being shot. And for documentaries, it's usually somewhere between 25 and 100 minutes of film per minute of actual film.
Wow.
And at 4K, you're burning through a gig a minute of storage. And we're shooting with two cameras. So, you know, for every hour interview, we need 120 gigs of storage for just raw files. And wow. So you can imagine just there is a technical piece of this of setting up, you know, network attack storage and backing it up and making sure there's a fire safe and, you know, just all these things that I've never really had to worry about when, you know, when I could throw everything in the cloud. But once you start to get into needing 14 terabytes, Dropbox becomes a little expensive.
Yes, I can imagine. You have a website where people can follow this?
Yes, at Hello World Film. There's a teaser up already and ways to get involved in the story of what we're trying to do. We're going to be doing we did a Kickstarter over Thanksgiving, and unfortunately, I pulled it because it wasn't doing that well because me, the idiot, decided to do it over Thanksgiving when no one's paying attention. So we're going to relaunch that, I think, in March, or it might be in April of this year, so people can get involved and can get, can decide to help us make the movie and get a copy of the movie when it comes out, and some other nice little gifts that we've got put together. And I'll certainly let everyone know when that hits. And we have a Kickstarter video that sort of talks more in depth than the teaser does. But you can see all that information at helloworldfilm.com.